Hello, everyone. This is The Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. Today's guest is Pete Papa Heracles from American Free Press.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
So when was American Free Press founded?
Well, American Free Press was founded in 2001, but it was a continuation of the Spotlight newspaper, which had been around since 1975. Around 2000 or 2001, the federal judge took them down. I don't remember the exact procedures, but it was one of these trumped up charges about some kind of, you know, problem or another. And they closed them down. They forced them to shut down, and they reopened as American Free Press. I was not with them at the time. I've only been with them for about three and a half years. But I used to read the Spotlight. Maybe the last couple of years, I had found out about it, I think in 98 or 99. So I was a subscriber at the time, and I used to order books also. From them. They had a book department. And I started working there around 2009. They had asked me to go to Greece in 2009 in the spring to help cover the Bilderberg conference that was being held there. And Jim Tucker is, is known as the Bilderberg hound. You know, he was one of the pioneers that exposed the Bilderberg Conference ever since the newspaper was founded, really. Willis Carter, the owner, the publisher of the newspaper, had asked him, knew about the Bilderberg. Although back in 75, very few people knew about it. And Jim had started going around, finding out where they're meeting and try to get in and get information from them and what have you. And in 2009, it was being held in Greece. So because I had gotten to know the people there at the newspaper, it's published in Washington, D.C., and I live in the vicinity there in Maryland. So they had asked me if I would go with Jim. And, they would pay my expenses and everything, so I said, sure. And, when I came back, they were happy with my work and what have you, and the help that I gave them, and asked me to work for them, and I did, and here I am.
The Golden Dawn in Greece was a big issue in the news, several months ago, around the time of the election, and it hasn't been in the American news as much as it was before, but you've written a number of articles on that, and you've sort of, first of all, there's sort of the media reaction to the Golden Dawn. How many seats in Parliament were they elected to? Was it just one or two?
No, there were 18 seats in Parliament. They have 18 seats in Parliament, and they got 7% of the electoral vote, of the national vote. So they had a strong showing. I met them back in 2009, in the fall of 2009. I didn't meet them, but I talked to them and had some connections there like that. And I called them and to interview the leader there, Nick Mihalakos. And by the time we got the interview, it was I guess right around maybe Christmas or gotten into maybe January of 2010, and the financial crisis in Greece broke out right after that, right as I had was getting the interview. I had given them the questions, and by the time they answered them, he answered them and what have you, the crisis had started at that time. So when I met them, when I took the interview, now this was for the web magazine also that's called the Barnes Review. It's a historical nationalist, revisionist magazine. Excellent magazine, by the way. I also write for that magazine there, and I work for them. But You know, the interview was for the Barnes Review, and at that time, the Golden Dawn had, in the recent elections that were held that November of 2009, they had gotten about 0.29% of the vote, less than one-third of a percent of the vote, and they were really happy. It was about like 20,000 votes or something, because they were, as a party, you know, they were a new party, and they were pretty, you know, small. They were just a nationalist movement. So they considered it at that time a big achievement that they had gotten 20,000 votes. So by the time the elections were held earlier this year, they got 500,000 votes. So they went from less than one-third of a percent to 7%. And they got 18 members in parliament, of course. Now, since...
And that's 18, is it, how many members of parliament on there?
300.
Oh, 300.
Yeah, it's 300 members, but there was a six or seven parties, I think, made it, and they were the number five party. 7% doesn't sound like a lot.
It is a lot, especially compared to what the third parties get in this country. They get, like, less than 1%.
Well, right, but yeah, of course it is, but The thing is, this was divided among seven parties, and the leading party only had like 25%. Anyway, you know, so and the one below that had like 20, and the third party I think had like 12 or so. So what was the most impressive was that they went from being one third of a percent to being 7%. As a matter of fact, the polls earlier this year in January only showed them at 1%, and then by May, when they had the first round of elections, they got 7%. Everybody was shocked, but because the government couldn't form a coalition, they had to have a second election in June, and they actually, you know, the mass media was like, "Oh, geez!" I mean, all they would say, you know, it was like Nazis, neo Nazis, fascists, you know, extremists, hooligans. They tried their best to really, you know, defame them as much as they could and slander them until the next election 6 weeks later. But they didn't succeed because they maintained, with all that media attack, they still maintained their 7%. Now, here's the interesting thing. Since then, now this was only... this was in the June, right? So we have now September, middle of September. It was the middle of June. So July, August, September, 3 months ago. Well, in the 1st of September, I read a report that they moved up to the number four party with 8.6%. 5 days later, I read another report from Reuters even that they moved up to the number three spot was 10.5%. And 3 or 4 days later, about a week ago, I see another poll to where they went up to 12%. So that is phenomenal. So they started out at about 1% in January, and they're already up to 12% in like 8 months, 9 months. So that's amazing.
Do you see something as unique about the situation in Greece? Because obviously that's very high compared to the countries like England and Germany. The amount, like if you look at the British National Party, they basically, I think they had a seat in Parliament and they lost it. So it seems to be, what is unique about the situation in Greece as opposed to other parts of Europe?
Well, you know, it's not only the situation. Of course, you know, this economic crisis and the illegal immigration epidemic, you know, which I guess, you know, all these countries in Europe have. Maybe Greece has gotten it a little too much of it and a little bit too quickly over the past few years. But nevertheless, you know, a lot of it has to just be the Golden Dawn itself. I mean, a lot of people try to take the credit away from them and just attributed to the, you know, the political climate or the situation. No, these guys are rocking and rolling. I mean, they're committed. you know, they're really dedicated. They're focused, and not that the crisis hasn't had a lot to do with it, but you know, they really people have really started realizing that these guys are for real, and I think they're really got a momentum going on now, because a lot more people used to always, I think, secretly back them up. But because of all the liberal brainwashing with the media and what have you, and the, you know, the leftist domination of the media and all that, I think, you know, they were portrayed as, you know, the old neo-Nazis, you know, pull out the old Hitler thing and make them be, you know, the, you know, evil fascists and ultra right wing extremists and hooligans and all that. And I think, you know, the people, you know, the masses in general, they can't really comprehend that the media is that controlled. So I think that was really the barrier to break, because all the people would hear was how terrible these guys are. But once they got that 7%, I think people started feeling like, hey, you know, I was kind of like these guys. You know, they kind of felt now that they weren't so much on the fringes. They weren't out on the limb if they supported the Golden Dawn. They wouldn't be just branded as, you know, crazies and you know, fanatics. So I think that's really what's happening. And these guys are really also showing, I mean, they walk their talk. You know, they're not just, you know, all ideology and everything. I mean, they, you know, they really practice what they preach. And they've really helped, they really helped with illegal immigration. I mean, everybody calls them whenever, you know, they get, whenever they have problems with illegal immigrants and all that. So they really have gotten a lot of, I think the Greek people have started to see them as a really strong force, the only force really that wants to get rid of illegal immigrants and send them back. You know, that is really their number one objective in their platform, and the only ones to have that as their number one objective. And of course, to repudiate the debt is also another one of their big platform, and go back to the old, you know, ideals, the old values, traditional values, and that type of thing.
So, what is this? You talk about the immigration situation in Greece, and I think what is unique about it, I mean, countries like England and France and Germany, they've been getting immigrants there since like the 1950s. But what's interesting about Greece is that the immigration situation is relatively new, but the numbers, the sheer numbers of it have been extremely rapid. Could you sort of go into some detail about the,
sure, yes,
the recent history or the history of immigration in Greece,
sure,
when it really got started?
Sure. I think the difference, as you pointed out, you know, with Britain or other of the Western European countries is, you know, these countries like Britain and France were colonial countries, you know, and they also had an industry. So for one thing, you know, after World War II, these countries were looking for workers. I mean, Germany always had Turks over there, or even Greeks or other minorities, or, you know, other non-Germans that would come in as workers because they had an industry. They had factories. They needed the help. The same with Britain. And these countries also had colonies. So a lot of their immigrants, let's say in Britain, maybe came from India or Pakistan or, you know, other places where they had colonies. And in France, you had the Algerians and the Moroccans and the Tunisians and, you know, places that France had gone to. Well, Greece never had any of that, you know, first of all. Nor did they have industry, of course, to need any extra help to come in because, you know, they didn't have enough working hands. So so I was born in Greece, and I went to, finished the fourth grade in Greece back in the 60s. And, you know, Greece was 99% white Greek Orthodox. I mean, there was no minorities. There was very few gypsies, and I don't know if there might have been a Muslim or two, or, you know, very few Jews or what have you. But that's it. 99%, very homogenous country. So it wasn't until the fall of the Soviet Empire, of the Soviet Union, that illegals started coming in. And around maybe 91, 92, we started getting some Albanians, because a lot of Greeks lived behind the Iron Curtain, you know, in Albania, and weren't allowed to leave, you know, throughout the, you know, since World War II. And even before, you know, the whole Balkans, Greece had the much bigger area of people that spoke Greek. So there was, you know, a substantial amount of Greeks in Albania that were Greek Orthodox, but lived in Albania. So as soon as the Iron Curtain fell, these guys were the first to come in. And they were accepted because they were sort of like, you know, our long-lost brothers, so to speak, and they came in. And of course, you know, you had behind that, you know, you had this agenda that was really starting, which was, well, they would work for cheaper, and they would pick the olives and the fruits, and maybe the Greeks weren't, you know, willing to work for that cheap. But it was mainly that they were coming back as repatriated Greeks. Well, behind these Albanians came other Albanians that were Muslim also, initially pretending to be Greek, you know. So this was in the early to mid-90s. And then throughout the 90s, you mainly had Albanians. Then you started having maybe some Romanians, some Poles, you know, I don't know, Bulgarians or what have you, Ukrainians. So you had the Eastern European type of people, which, again, were still white people, and, you know, half of them were Christian anyway. So that wasn't that big of a problem. I'm not sure exactly when the Muslims started coming in. I would have to say that it was somewhere in the early 2000s, you know, and I don't know when that shift really happened.
Do the Albanian Muslims, do they identify more with Europeans or with their fellow Muslims from outside of Europe?
I don't know. You know, there's a, you know, that whole area there, there's an agenda that has to do with Turkey, you know, because you have like a whole, it's almost like a whole strip of Muslim, they have like a foothold in Europe, the Muslims there, that ranges from a little bit in Bulgaria and a lot more in like Kosovo and even more in Albania and into like Bosnia. You know, there's like that Muslim leftovers from the Ottoman Empire, right? So whether these guys identify more as Muslims, you know, I'm not quite sure. But I think the problem really happened with after the wars, we started the war after 9/11, where the United States and, you know, the whatever, the allied countries, you know, with Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think a lot of them started coming in as refugees, right? And I think maybe to an extent in the beginning, it was all, you know, that sympathy of like, well, you know, they're war refugees and, you know, let's take them in and what have you. And then, I mean, everybody started coming in. So I would say the bulk of these immigrants have probably come in the last, less than a decade, and more in the last 3 or 4 years. So yes, it's I'm not sure exactly how it worked with Britain, but I guess the you know, they probably started coming in since the 80s or so, right?
And then there's sort of, there's this sort of issue, a greater issue with people talk about this sort of Islamification of Europe. I know one of your colleagues on American Free Press, Michael Collins Piper, I've listened to his show on the Republic Broadcast Network, and he's kind of very, very pro-Muslim, and he's always like, for a while he was doing these shows where he was very angry at these European nationalists for bashing Muslims, and where he's coming from is he sees sort of like the neocons or the the Israeli lobby and all that interest, like, really exploiting the Muslim issue. And he's absolutely right about that.
Right.
But the thing is, I mean, the Muslim immigration in Europe is still a huge problem in its own right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny you said that, because we had this very conversation with Mike today. And, yeah, I mean, I love Mike. He's a good friend of mine and colleague. And we agree on many things, but, you know, we don't agree on everything. And it was this exact conversation that we were having today, really. And, yes, he sees the fact that, you know, the Muslims are being attacked by Zionism. And of course, we know that that's true, especially starting with the Palestinians. But, you know, now having spread to so many other Muslim countries. So surely that agenda is there, and the Muslims are the victims of that. I think what's happened is this. I think, you know, the Zionists, of course, are playing off Christians against the Muslims, while they themselves, or we can even just say Israel, perhaps, and while they themselves are sort of in the, you know, sitting in the shade. So in the United States, we have gotten to see the Muslims as the bad guys due to 9/11. When any, you know, deeper research as to who did 9/11 will show that it was really not the Muslims. So in Europe, again, they've got the white Christian people seeing the Muslims as the enemy because they're being invaded by the Muslims. So in both cases, I mean, if you really look at who's really pulling the strings of world control and world domination, you know, the Zionism and Israel and the Rothschilds and, you know, these forces have a lot more to do with it than anybody else. Yet, in the old divide and conquer game, they want to have the Christians basically looking at the Muslims as the enemy and not seeing who's behind allowing the Muslims to flood Europe. So I think you know, Mike is more sensitive toward that, and he sees that, you know, the Muslims aren't really, you know, the problem. But I think he downplays the fact that regardless of who's behind allowing illegal immigration to become rampant, both in Europe and here, nevertheless, you still do have a lot of Muslims in Europe. I mean, that's not so much the case here.
To be fair to Piper, he doesn't necessarily defend immigration. He just doesn't really – he's just opposed to people saying anything directing their animus towards Muslims, which obviously most European nationalists do. But he's not.
Exactly.
He's not at all pro-immigration. I wouldn't say he's pro-immigration at all either.
No, no, but I don't think he appreciates how bad the problem is. I think because
I don't know if he's been. I don't. The thing is, maybe he hasn't really been to Europe, traveled around Europe extensively. That could be part of it.
Exactly. Exactly, and I don't know. You know, I think he's sort of focused on the plight of the Palestinians and how the you know, the Muslims have been so brutally attacked by by us for one thing, and. You know, all these countries, you know, starting with the Palestinians, of course, but, you know, you have, I mean, now the thing is to get Iran, which, of course, you know, has no nuclear weapons that anybody knows of. They've signed the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. They undergo routine inspection by the International Atomic Energy Commission. So they're perfectly within the rights to be developing peaceful nuclear energy and have not made any violations. Yet they're made, you know, the media and everything has made a total heightened danger of, you know, them being a danger to everybody else, which is the same thing they did with Saddam Hussein, the same thing they did with Gaddafi, same thing they did with the Taliban and bin Laden and that whole thing. It's the same scenario. So Mike is a, you know, he sees that, and very rightfully so. very rightfully sees that the Muslims are really the scapegoats in this situation. So he has sympathy for them, but I personally think that, that sort of gets him to not be as objective as he could be with the reality of what's going on in Europe, because you have 54 million Muslims in Europe, and they produce, 6.8 children per couple, while the Europeans produce 1.5 children per couple. Well, you do the math, and even if no more Muslims came in, already in one generation, you're going to have the Muslims be, almost as many as the whites, as the white Christians. So Mike doesn't, I think, acknowledge that, and I don't even know that he really appreciates why that would even be a problem.
One thing I get from a lot, there are a lot of people out there who are they're anti-Zionist, but the thing about it is they make anti-Zionism their core ideology. And I think for a Palestinian, obviously, that's totally rational. But for someone who's of European origin, I think it's a little silly to put their anti-Zionism before their own nationalism.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Robert. And I think what happens is, you being a nationalist and, being involved with, you're in the Voice of Reason or you've been involved with that theme, I'm sure, for years, and you're very aware of what's going on. Well, not all whites really, understand the race issue. And even for those that have been exposed to these issues for a long time, like Mike, let's say, they perhaps don't put it in the proper priority that maybe we do, So I think he sees the problem, but I don't know that he really fully appreciates it, like somebody that identifies strongly with putting the white race first as a race. I think, all of us in the United States, to some degree or other, are, intimidated from really looking at things from that point of view, I mean, I've stated that I would vote for Romney simply because he's white, and I've caught a lot of flack for saying that. And I don't think he's any better than Barack Obama, except for the fact that, maybe he's got a valid birth certificate and some other records, that Obama can't produce. But nevertheless, 95% of the blacks voted for Obama just because he's black. Well, so both of these guys are controlled. I don't have any illusions, that Romney's going to save the day. But if I have to pick my crook, I'll pick a white crook. That's how I see it. So, Mike seems to support, he definitely supports Barack Obama big time. And
I don't think he doesn't support Obama. Maybe he views him as a lesser of evils, but he's.
Well, no, he actually supports Obama, and he thinks that, Obama actually, is giving the Zionists a run for their money. And I think he thinks that, had it not been for, had Romney been president or had McCain won the elections, that we definitely would have been at war with Iran. So I think from his point of view, he puts the war with Iran issue as the number one issue. And surely it is a great issue. Let's not kid ourselves, because a war with Iran basically translates to a World War III. So I think, he sees that as the number one issue. But in my opinion, he falsely attributes why we haven't gotten to that war to Obama. I think if we have not yet gotten started on that war, it's because of other obstacles that they haven't really worked out yet. But not because Obama is really that adamant on stopping that. Mike feels that it is Obama, and he feels, and you know, that these guys are really clever, the Zionists. You know, I mean, they control everything. They control the media. So with these elections that we're having, there's all these false illusions, you know, that are being built as far as who Obama is and who Romney is and this and that. So they're trying to portray, you know, Obama as like anti-Semitic somehow, like he's really not giving, you know, helping the Jews or helping Israel, you know, while Israel is being threatened by Iran. You know, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Israel is not threatened by Iran, obviously. But at the same time, it's not that Obama, I really don't buy into the fact that Obama is really the reason we're not at war with Iran. But somehow Mike does see it that way. And he thinks that if the, you know, Romney gets in there, you know, that he's, you know, in bed with Netanyahu and the neocons. And boy, they're going to attack Iran the very next day. So it really comes down to that. It really comes down to that being the core issue with him, why he thinks that, you know, Obama is the better choice here.
I guess what reminds me a little bit of within the sort of white nationalist, I remember when David Duke endorsed this black, do you know that there was a black councilman in New York who was running for Congress who was, he's extremely anti-white. He made some, it's something Barron. I don't know what it is, but Charles Barron, that's right. He made some comments. Okay. I'd like to walk up to the next white guy and like smack him in the face. But he's also, what's interesting about him is he's also very, very kind of, very, very anti-Zionist. And he was running against another black guy for Congress who was part of the establishment. And David Duke came out and endorsed him. And there was some kind of a little bit of controversy among some of his supporters. I mean, some people were talking about his motivation. Some people
David
would say,
Duke endorsed the David Duke endorsed the black congressman.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is, I mean, it's possible Duke could be looking at it from a strategic standpoint of getting him in there to kind of like cause divide within the enemy. But then there's some people this issue comes up like there's people out there who would vote for. Like, for someone who's anti-white, as long as they're anti-Zionist.
Right, right, yeah. There's a so it comes down to putting these beliefs, I guess, and in the proper perspective. And I think it varies with different people as far as whether they you know, do they identify themselves first as you know, Republicans or Democrats or whites or Christians or what have you. And I think the patriot movement, if you will, you know, we see some variation with that because you see some people identifying strongly as Christians. And even within the Christians, you have all these divisions, of course. And then, with a more hardcore nationalists, you know, that maybe don't identify with that much as Christians. Well, you have different degrees of how much you put race above other things, you know. And then you have the Zionist or the Israel, the Jewish issue, which of course is to what degree do you see that as a major threat to what's happening in the world. So I think you have a wide range of how people perceive how their self-identity is, how they view themselves, and how they view what's happening in the world and as far as which issues are the most dominant issues. So Zionism, of course, is a dominant issue. The majority of the people are in denial of that because of this whole, you know, Hitler scare and Nazi and Holocaust and the Jews being victims and what have you. And a lot of people can't see through that. And then you have the race issue, of course, to where, again, because of, again, Hitler and, the Ku Klux Klan, and you don't want to be a bigot and a racist and whatever. So a lot of people have been intimidated into not identifying themselves as white because they don't want to be perceived as racist. So, you know, from the one point of view, some don't want to be perceived as anti-Semites, others don't want to be perceived as racists, others don't want to be perceived as anti-Christian. So, you know, you have all these different ranges of, you know, identity and what position people take.
Yeah, I think you see that a lot with this sort of anti-Islam or anti-jihad movement, which is popular among sort of a lot of the Tea Party crowd. And I think they get attracted to it because, in a sense, it's a lot more politically correct to be anti-Muslim than to be involved with all those other issues that you brought up.
Exactly. That's a very good point that you're making. And I think, you know, the Zionists are playing that card very strongly. And they're playing it here and they're playing it in Europe to where it's more politically expedient or acceptable to be anti-Muslim, you know, than to be anti-Semitic in this case, or racist, you know. So,
or they say that a Muslim immigration is a problem because it threatens sort of like values like women's rights or gay rights, and that's sort of the most politically correct line to take. But they won't say anything about it's a problem because it's displacing their people. They find the most politically correct ways to criticize Islam or Muslims.
Exactly. And again, it comes down to where you put your values as far as identifying yourself as a white person, just as a white man, you know. And most people are a little bit shy with going all the way with that. So they, like you just said, of course, very astutely, that they identify the threat as more of a cultural threat rather than a survival of the demographics of the race problem, you know, which ultimately it is what it is. When you really look at it for what it is, I mean, like the real hardcore examination of what's going on, it is really a form of genocide of the white race. I mean, if you were really to really, really be hardcore about it, because demographics is destiny, you know? So when you displace a population and they become a minority in their own country, as whites have become in London now, then the whole, you know, the whole game changes, doesn't it?
And the thing is, throughout history, I think it's a unique situation with there were mass migrations throughout history, but whenever it happened in history, there was always there is violence, of course, going on today. I'm not denying that, but the violence was on a larger scale, and it was almost like a war was inevitable when you saw a mass migration from one area to another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So this, you know, this white race being endangered is it's almost like a big taboo for a lot of people, a big blind spot that they really don't want to see, and it's kind of a scary thing to really come to terms with for somebody that hasn't acknowledged it yet. When you look at the fact that even, you know, in 1950, the world was, the whites made up something like 28% of the world population. And I think blacks made up something like 9%. And now, depending on what statistics you go with, whites are down to, some people say that they're under 10%. I don't think that's the case. I think they're maybe 15 to 18%, but still, you know, we have come down, we're almost like half of what we used to be at 1950. And then if you take World War I, World War II, the Bolshevik Revolution, you had over 100 million white people got killed there. It wasn't black people, it wasn't Orientals, Asians, it was white people. So when you really look at the population, the white race, we really are taking a big hit, and we don't reproduce at all, because the you know, well, very little. We not enough to sustain our population. We need to reproduce at 2.1 or 2.2 children per couple, and we're really down to 1.6 on an average, I think. So we're definitely declining. And then when you see the, you know, the blacks here, and then you see the Muslims in Europe and in their own places, really, and even the you know, the Hispanics here, all of them, you know, all these minorities, if you will, soon to be majorities, they all reproduce, you know, 5, 6, 7 children. And the system is set up here to basically promote that, because they get paid to do that. I mean, the government takes care of that, you know, so which they don't for whites. You know, I mean, it's really reverse racism, you know, so it's almost like it's been set up to promote that type of a trend. And that's what's kind of scary.
So that's where people use the word genocide. I think it is there's this debate about what genocide is. Most people think of genocide as a large scale extermination of a people using. But based on the UN definition, putting in place policies that would displace a people or cause their numbers to decline, by the UN's definition, that is a form of genocide.
There you go. Well, by that definition, then that's exactly what we're seeing on the white race. And it's happening here. It's happening in Europe. It's definitely happening in South Africa. There's actually going to be a demonstration here I need to cover this coming weekend down here in Washington. It's about South Africa. And I'm sure you know what's going on in South Africa, but the majority of the people, due to the controlled media, are clueless. And even if they did know, they probably would think that the whites have it coming. I mean, with 68,000 white people have been killed since the Nelson Mandela took over the National Congress in 1994, right? So 68,000 people. You have the president of the country getting up there singing in front of thousands of people, kill the Boer, kill the Boer, kill the Boer with your machine gun, kill the Boer. And everybody's dancing to it. And they're killing them, all right. I mean, you know, they're killing them, taking it in brutal ways. And most people don't know about that. Most people have no idea, you know, that that's happening. They still think that, you know, since Nelson Mandela took over, you know, South Africa has been a utopian place of fairness and peace, love, and brotherhood, you know? And even if they do hear some of these things, they'll probably say, well, gee, Whitey had it coming for all the evils he did and the exploitation he did to the blacks, you know?
Yeah, it's just remarkable how, like, your average, the way you're basically your average person is, and the way they think and the way they kind of view the world.
Yeah, of course, it's that white guilt that we've been indoctrinated with, at least since the end of World War II, you know, and with the civil rights movement and all that. You know, in this country first, but then in Europe more recently, you know, we have been made to believe that whatever shortcomings the blacks have always had are really attributable to what we have done to them. And that's been promoted by a media with an agenda on the American people. And it's been, what, two or three generations now since Brown versus Board of Education was, what, 1954? And then that started that whole victim, you know, that the blacks, well, I guess you can, if you want to go technically, started back with the publishing of Uncle Tom's Cabin back in 1852. And, you know, the whole Civil War thing. But, you know, in our generation, in our time, really was with the Civil Rights Movement. And, gee, ever since then, you know, the propaganda has been that, you know, look how much the black people have suffered and how abusive the whites have been to them. And we owe them. And nothing we do is can ever make it up to them, really. And that's really the attitude that they've promoted. And unfortunately, too many whites have bought into it.
Well, it's interesting if you look at the so-called liberals and so-called conservatives, how the dynamics have changed. If you go back to like before the civil rights era, or even during that, I mean, the conservatives back then were explicitly pro-white. They would be considered racist by today's standards. Then the liberals came around, and the liberals were talking about having this colorblind society. And now you have it. The liberals are explicitly supporting these sort of double standards and saying that sort of whites, defending the sort of white guilt. And the conservatives are the ones that are talking about a colorblind society. Like you hear sort of like Glenn Beck trying to like take Martin Luther King's a mantle.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I had covered that, the Tea Party demonstration that was happening there when Glenn Beck was there. And sure, yeah, I had even done a political cartoon about it, I remember, because, you know, he was there trying to be the heir to Martin Luther King, right? You know, so it's whites are just so confused. And I remember several conversations I had with whites that were there, and they all had bought into this. Nobody had any signs or anything. It wasn't a demonstration. They were kind of told what they could do and what they couldn't do. And Martin Luther King's daughter, I think, or somebody got up there to speak. Somehow they managed to turn it into a civil rights protest rather than, let's just all get along. We're like a big, although it was 95% white people that were there, it's almost like they were all corralled there and somehow made to identify with being I don't know, Obama supporters or something. It was weird. It's exactly what you said though about how Glenn Beck basically, in a sense, co-opted, you know, the Tea Party, him and others.
Well, that's definitely true, but not just that. I mean, my main point is that conservatives today are sort of they carry sort of the mantle of liberals of the past, as liberals sort of become more extreme on those issues especially.
I see. And what would be the more extreme direction that the liberals have gone off to, would you say?
I'm talking about like you were saying that like whites have about white guilt, and that whites have to sort of make amends for the amends for their sort of like so-called crimes.
Right.
Then
yeah.
Conservatives take the old liberal position that we should just all come together as Americans, or all come together. We're all human, and like none of this stuff should really matter and divide us. And I mean, I look at this sort of.
That's interesting. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I look at this sort of issue of a multiculturalism, and I sort of in my sort of more kind of a patriotard days, I was sort of like multiculturalism is bad because it divides people, and we should just sort of come together as Americans. But I sort of look at the situation today, and I think multiculturalism is sort of a code word. It's sort of a code word for displacement against whites. But we've sort of gotten into this a point where I think America is already gone, and not just the demographic issue. I think the culture has been totally – the culture in this country has been kind of totally sterilized by a lot of this mass consumerism. So I don't – I think – I kind of think it's a good thing for people to identify more with – not just for European Americans to identify with maybe their European heritage, but I also think it's good for people to have strong connections to their local, have kind of regional identities or local identities.
Yes, absolutely. you know, I think if you look at this a little bit, you know, maybe the bigger picture, you know, what we're seeing is the result of several generations of what you would call maybe Frankfurt School type of propaganda and brainwashing that has taken place, which would be to, you're familiar with the Frankfurt School, I presume?
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, their ideology was, it was basically covert communism is what it was. And the idea was to basically demonize the white male. And I guess it was Theodore Adorno, he had written The Authoritarian Personality. And the idea was that if you believed, you know, that the white male should be the patriarch of the family, well, you needed to go for psychiatric psychoanalysis or something because you suffered from, you had an authoritarian personality. So the idea was they promoted the concept that the white man had been the root of all problems, and you know, the women were supposed to rebel against their man, the children were supposed to rebel against their fathers, the blacks were supposed to rebel against the whites. So they somehow created this, you know, this mass idea that the white man, the white male, was the root of all problems. First of all, there was no problems. They created the problems. But, you know, they promised, you know, they got all these minorities, if you will, to turn against the white man. And I think, you know, like women were told that they were victimized by their man because they weren't allowed to go to work and they had to stay home and clean the house and be, you know, housewives and mothers and whatever. And somehow they were made to feel like they didn't get a chance to really express themselves because they were forced by man to be in that position. Well, they weren't forced by man. They were forced by nature. That's how it always had been. And that's how we were created, you know. But these guys were really clever in creating a problem where there was none. And it was the same thing with the blacks. You know, I mean, the blacks really didn't have a problem. The blacks didn't want Brown versus Board of Education any more than the whites did. You know, they were content being, you know, in their own schools and in their own places. And they didn't really care about this back of the bus and all that and whether we're going to drink from the same water fountain. Everything had worked out fairly okay with no problem for a long time. It was all these liberals that basically started something out of nothing, you know. So that's really what we are seeing the fruits of that communist, crypto-communist subversion, if you will, that has become metamorphosized into a political correctness now, you know.
What you were talking about earlier is, I think, people's identities are based on who they view as their main adversary. And that's obviously with a lot of these groups. We talked about the anti-jihad group or the anti-Zionist. So I think it's really important to sort of analyze the power structure, and because everyone has a tendency to want to focus on sort of this, they base their political identity on their main adversary.
Mm-hmm. Oh, on who they're against rather than what they're for, you mean? Or
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like I said, I think a lot of it, partly because of what I said and about the Frankfurt School and the indoctrination of you know, of this white guilt that the whites don't see themselves as proud to be white. It's almost like they have a guilt that's been put there to them to identify as white. So now they want to identify as equal rights advocates or something, or equal multicultural advocates, or equality of some form, or support gay rights, or support I don't know, any number of stupid issues that really don't mean anything. But I think the last thing that they want to do is just say, hey, you know, I'm a white man, I'm a white male, or even a white female, and that's important to me. I think that's been conditioned out of them, and I don't know how to turn that back around, not in this country anyway. I think in maybe Eastern Europe, you don't have that as much. Even in Greece, you're starting to see more of that because the media has been. See, it's really interesting to see the differences. Like in Greece, for instance, where you see the younger generation that's been exposed to, you know, really 24/7 type of TV for maybe the last, I don't know, 15 years, maybe 20 years. So you see them that they've bought a lot more into this equality, political correctness, and what have you. And they feel like they have to be more like the West and be more European and more like, you know, up to par with the modern ideas. But, you know, the older people haven't quite been brainwashed into that. Whereas here, we've been subjected to that, for two generations, since the 50s, really, you know. So here it's become more pervasive because, I mean, you see these children today and they're sort of like these young people today, and they're children of the hippie generation, you know, who were already into the civil rights movement. So you have a second and third generation now of people that have bought into this, this whole equality stuff.
So the thing about it, well, you brought up the issue with the white guilt, and that's not – I think that is one of the reasons of the – you said the success of the Golden Dawn is the white guilt is the strongest, I think, in the United States and in the former colonial powers and also in Germany because of their past. But in Eastern Europe and even Southern European countries like Greece and Italy, I don't think it's as strong.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Italy, I don't know exactly what the deal with Italy is. I had gone to Italy. I was there about 7 years. No, not so, about 5 years ago. And I had been there maybe 20, 25 years ago, a couple of times. And, I really saw a lot more, Algerians and Moroccans and this and that and gypsies and all that. Now, whether they're more westernized to have somehow accepted some of this, are they like the Eastern Europeans? I'm not sure. Do you feel that way? Do you feel Italy is a little bit more like old school as far as that goes?
You know, I've heard some people say that. It's hard for me to be decisive about that, but I have heard some people say that. But I think if you look at the future, I think there's sort of a time where a lot of people want to hold on to this sort of American patriotism, and we get to a point as I think a lot of people have a strong emotional attachment to America. But I think what's going to happen is I think people are just going to kind of give up on America and let America go. And then you'll see, but then in other parts of the world, other places will rise up.
So I think,
and then people will sort of get, who are left in America, will get sort of inspiration from that, from those movements in other countries. But I think it's sort of that's kind of what the Tea Party is about. A lot of the people, they want to sort of like hold on to this sort of last gasp of Americanism.
Yeah, I think so.
Like a sentimental thing rather than something that's truly concrete.
Yes, absolutely. We have to look into the future. And the thing is, who can we look to as an example of what we want to happen in the future? The Golden Dawn is an example of a group that is growing, that has a lot of people behind it. That identify with what they believe. They don't want the illegal immigrants. They want them out. But the illegal immigrants are still there, and there's more of them coming. The system seeing the pressure of the people now wanting to get rid of the illegal immigrants, they go through these shenanigans of pretending to round them up, but then they just kind of let them go again, and they maybe they'll ship off, like, I don't know, 100 of them. So the system, the people that are in charge of the countries, are not there to serve the interests of the people, unfortunately. They're there to promote globalization. And you see this in all the countries. If you were to take a poll in any of the European countries, I bet you 95% of the people, except the really, really brainwashed liberals, the rest of them would say, hey, we don't need these illegal aliens. We don't want them. We don't need them. They add to our crime. They destroy our way of life, everything. But they can't get rid of them. Why? Why can't one of these governments in Europe say, okay, enough is enough. That's it. All of you have, I don't know, 48 hours to just round up. And, you know, we'll put your airfare, give you a couple hundred euros, and just go off to your country. Just be gone, you know? How come nobody has the political muscle or the political will to do that? It's really not that hard. It's really not that hard. But the people in charge are actively working against the will of the people. You know, the government is actively working against the will of the people. So the Golden Dawn is really trying to do something about it. And, you know, they're forced to take matters into their own hands. But then the government is making them look like they're hooligans and that they're criminals and trying to prosecute them. So they can only go so far in, you know, trying to restore some order in the country from all the damage that's being done by the illegal aliens. But that is really the thing. Unless the governments themselves are forced to serve the will of the people, unless the people really become a lot more rebellious and a lot more clear about the fact that these illegal aliens have to go, and unless the governments support them, these illegals will multiply and they will become, it's not that long, it won't take that long, it's already happening, right? And then how are you going to get rid of them? It's not going to be so easy to get rid of them. We're really facing some tough battles ahead, and we need to look at I think we need to be clear on a workable solution of how to get how to get rid of the illegal aliens. And I don't know if you've seen the model of any particular country that that is workable and that others could follow.
That's an immediate problem that has to be dealt with, but I think the root problem is removing those who are in power, who are responsible for the problem. You talk about illegal immigrants. That's sort of the symptom. The root of it is sort of the treasonous elites.
You're 100% correct.
So that was Pete Papaheracles from American Free Press. I'd like to thank you again for being on.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.